All right. Good afternoon and welcome to our DE&I thought leader interview. Thanks for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Corinne Post, who will be speaking with us this hour. So Corinne is the Fred J. Springer Endowed Chair in Business Leadership and Professor of Management at Villanova School of Business. So this interview is an element of IRI's diversity, equity, and inclusion community. And the DEI community provides resources and networking opportunities for members as they promote DEI in their innovation and R&D practices specifically. So as this community grows, it's brand new. We only started in February. You'll be able to access facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics. We have those on the second Thursday of the month, and our next one's tomorrow. So I hope you'll join us for that. White papers with fresh, relevant content, updates with insights and additional resources, and interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. These will almost always take place on the second Thursday of the month at 12 p.m. Eastern, except next month we're getting bumped for the IRI annual conference. So it's going to be on Monday, June 13th. So I'll be sure to make sure you get information on that one. So I'll also make sure you get updates and information on the DE&I community. And if you want to opt out of those, just let me know. Just a few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin our conversation. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will not be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. And then once we open the floor to questions, you can type your question into the chat and I'll read it out for you, or you can unmute and have a face-to-face conversation. We do like to encourage those because it makes for a fun interview. With all that out of the way, again, Corinne, thanks so much for joining me here today.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
All right, so tell us a bit about your background.
Sure.
You are.
Happy to do so. So I've been in academia for studying diversity and inclusion and equity issues for about 25 years. Before that, I was at Accenture as a consultant, and I just found after a few years that I was much more interested in why people behave the way they do at work. And so that's when I decided to do that, as pursue that as a career, answering those questions in particular. So I completed my PhD at Rutgers, and my interest in topics related to diversity have shifted and accumulated, I would say, over the years. I started out being keenly interested in the career trajectories of scientists and engineers. Who is more innovative? Who is more successful? What do these career trajectories look like? And particularly, how does somebody's race, ethnicity, gender, how does that influence the shape a career trajectory takes for scientists and engineers? So that's where I started out. And then a few years into this work, my advisor got a knock on her door from IRI to work on a project and to help address an issue that one of the working groups had around diversity, specifically on teams. So that's when I became, you know, involved in that project and developed a strong interest in understanding, you know, what makes diverse teams succeed. What are the factors you want to avoid so that they don't fail? So that was just, I would say, that addition, another layer to this interest in scientists and engineers' careers is what happens in the teams, innovation teams in particular. And maybe 10 years ago, then I became interested as well on in the role of diversity at the top echelons in corporations. So in boards of directors, in top management teams, trying to understand how diversity might affect how firms go around doing what they're doing, the kinds of decisions they make. So I continue to be interested in all these aspects, the careers, the diverse teams, as well as top management. And they really actually tie into each other, because if you think about it, people's careers unfold over time and they create the person that they are when they get to these executive roles down the line. So all these three things sort of layer onto each other and work together.
Okay, so you say your early research was focused on the career trajectories of science and engineers and how, you know, belonging to a particular group impacted those trajectories. Can you share some more about that research? That's super relevant for us.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, what I find fascinating is that each one of us can choose what we want to do with our lives, right? We're in control of all of our decisions. And so you'd expect to see all these different ways in which people organize their lives. But if you like take this 30,000 feet view and look down at people and like look, map out these career trajectories, what you find is that there are these very systematically different ways in which people's careers unfold depending on, for example, which social groups they belong to, right? So while we all make our individual choices, you know, and have that agency, at the end of the day, there is something out there that creates these systematically different patterns in these trajectories. So I thought that was really fascinating. And that was the initial work that I have been doing. And so the key idea that we brought to the picture is that, you know, being part of a particular group, being a female, being a minority, is not neutral, right? There are a lot of things that go along with being part of a group like that. And so what seems really important is not just whether a group is in a minority or majority in a particular setting. Certainly there are some groups that are in minority or majority roles and that can shape a career trajectory, but it also has to do with how much power a particular group might have in a given social setting. So if you think, for example, just at some countries, a small group of people is very powerful. So in this case, it's not the numbers that matter, but it's, you know, the access to those decision-making roles that is critical in giving people within that group more chances of success, for example. And the third part is status. So you could be a social group in a particular context that receives a lot of deference, that is seen as very competent, that's very respected. And again, they don't need to be in a majority and they don't need to hold positions of power. But so numbers, power, and status are three ways in which different social groups can be distinguished and classified, if you like. And if you're a member of any of those groups, you benefit from the way that group as a whole is seen in society, right? So if you're in a group that has overall generally more power, people assume you are more powerful. If you're part of a group that's assumed to be more competent, you're seen as having more competence. So we brought this idea to science and engineering. And in science and engineering, we know for sure there are minority groups in terms of numbers, right? But one thing that's important in these contexts is, for example, having a PhD, right? People with a PhD have higher status, right? Of course, being the lead on a project, you have more power. And so what this initial project looked at is to try to see whether being in a group that typically in the science and engineering workforce has more power, more status and numbers, would explain why people in that group would have more access to good job opportunities, would be evaluated more positively, independent of their actual individual performance. So it's really trying to separate out the individual performance from belonging in a group and benefiting from belonging in a group. And so we also, in that research, didn't want to consider just individual attributes like just gender or just race, because they sort of work together. So for example, in the science and engineering workforce, you have, you know, the race for sure, right, is important, gender is important, but also being born in the US are not as important. So white men who are not born in the US are much more likely to have a PhD, for example, than white US born men in the same workforce. And so we compared groups of people based on race, gender, and country of origin, and compared who got more or less good opportunities, so opportunities that we know lead to further success. And also we looked at whether they were evaluated more or less positively, with the idea, again, that each of these groups had more or less status, power, and numbers. And so what we found that was really notable is that US white men had better access to opportunities that, from a career perspective, we know, you know, is an upwards or a success trajectory in R&D, And they got better evaluations from everybody, right? U.S. born white women got some advantages. They got relatively better opportunities to like stepping stones in their careers, but not necessarily better evaluations. These white men that were not U.S. born also got some advantage, but not quite the same as the U.S. born white men. We didn't find a lot of evidence of discrimination. So it wasn't like, you know, a black men, for example, were being put aside, or Asian men were being put aside. We did find some negative effects for U.S. born black women. But in general, the big picture was, you know, if you are in a group that has these advantages, you have this positive discrimination, if you want, that happens. And so the key finding was this idea that the structural position of your group in a society has, you know, contributes to your success above and beyond what you do. So it's sort of a contrast to this idea of meritocracy, where the, you know, the best person gets ahead. No, there's not, it's not just that, right?
Yeah, the positive discrimination that really resonates. You know, it's that extra boost, you know. So how did that lead into the research with IRI? Because you said you kind of, that was the trajectory that you took.
Yes. So they were not necessarily directly related, because IRI approached us because they were very much interested in thought diversity. Right, so there's a whole period of time where there was an increased focus on thought diversity. And of course, there's some notion that perhaps if you have people that look differently, you also have people that think differently. But this project, we're specifically interested about on thought diversity and teams. And so the folks at IRI and Tom Turpak was one of those. I don't know if it rings a bell. Raju Borwanker was another one. Of course, he's not with us anymore. Those are just some names that pop up. They came to us and they said, you know what? We've heard that diversity is good. And so we've taken these groups, created diverse groups, you know, locked people up in a room that are diverse. But then when we unlocked the door, you know, a certain, you know, weeks later, innovation hasn't happened. So what is it about this whole diversity thing? Like, how can we make it work? So that was the real puzzle they were struggling with, you know, this idea, this beautiful notion that diversity, you know, creates innovation, and then the reality of it's not quite working. And so we worked with IRI, and when I say we, my advisor, Nancy DiTomaso at the time was part of this as well. And I think you'll have her later on a podcast, I believe. And so we worked with different folks at IRI to think about, you know, to develop a survey so that we could survey innovation teams and get a sense of what was happening on these teams, how people were leading, what the team composition was. And we had really great success. Almost 30 companies, 30 member companies participated. We had over 80 teams that completed the survey, and we were able to get almost 100% response rate on those teams, which is really important if you're trying to get to what happens on teams. You can't just rely on one or two people.
Yeah, that's amazing response rate.
it was an amazing response rate, and we worked hard to get it, but it was important for us that we get it. The other piece too is that we had, you know, the team, forget how we call them, maybe team champions, external stakeholders rate the team rather than self rating. So that was helpful too. So yeah, that was the idea, you know, to try to figure out what kind of thought diversity do we really need. What kind of behaviors are going to help these teams succeed to be more innovative? So that was sort of the puzzle we went with.
So based on this, you know, what are some tips for making sure diverse R&D teams get the tools and support they need? Because that's the key, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we found a few things that some might be make sense, and some I think are more interesting and more novel. So I would say five key ideas that came out of this. One of them is that functional diversity really helped teams. More functionally diverse teams were much more likely to, you know, be innovative and also exhibit some behaviors. You can never really predict or plan innovation, but you can encourage behaviors that we know can lead to innovation, right? So more functional diverse teams had more of these behaviors and seemed to do more radical innovation. One of the thought diversity pieces that we were interested in was this idea of sequential thinking and connective thinking. So sequential thinking is a preference for thinking in very methodological ways, very linear ways, you know, to think things out before you try them out, to use proven methods. That's what we call sequential thinking. And then connective thinking is more enjoying the challenge of putting things together that have never really been put together before, you know, trying different approaches to get to a particular outcome. So what we found is that teams that had more of this connective thinking were more likely to be innovative. And connective thinking, so what do you do with this finding? Like, what does that practically mean? People, when you have a team with people that have more educational, if there's more educational background variety on the team, so people, when you're taught to think a particular way about a problem, right? And so when you have multiple different educational backgrounds, that can really help approach a problem from different angles. But even if you don't have much of that, you can still try to encourage a team to, you know, to try different methods to arrive at an outcome, or to encourage, you know, a parallel experimentation to try out again different ways of getting to a solution. So functional diversity, doing less sequential thinking and more connective thinking. The other piece that was really interesting, and I actually found that fascinating, is when you have functionally diverse teams, there's this tendency to just, you know, give, let the functional expert lead a particular part of the project that's their functional expertise. So it's almost like you have this function, this functional variety on a team, and you just keep throwing the ball to the functional expert in one particular area. That really doesn't work well for innovation. What works is when you have people that engage in what we call collaborative learning. So that what that means is, for example, Lee, if I know enough about your job, I won't ever know everything about your job. But if I know enough to know how you're going to respond to a particular situation, or what your concerns are, or who your constituents are, that I can at least somehow put myself in your shoes without becoming an expert, right? But there's enough, and then you know enough about, you know, how I do things, rather than just tossing the ball to each other. If there's that collaborative learning that occurs, those teams did really well because they had a better understanding of, you know, how everything would ultimately connect and could put themselves on other people's shoes. So that's something you want to do if you have a functionally diverse team, is, you know, really get them to at least learn a little bit from each other that they understand and can think about how the other person would respond. There are two more. One that's had a lot of attention, we don't need to spend a lot of time on it, is this idea of psychological safety. So when on a team, there's psychological safety, there's more innovation. But the other part that's also fascinating about diversity is that, you know, when we're a group of people, that, you know, a diverse group of people always has some things that they have in common, plus their individual background. And there's this just very human tendency to want to focus on what we all have in common, because we can better relate to each other. It just makes things easier. And there are a bunch of reasons why people resist bringing their individual knowledge to the background. Maybe it contradicts others. But even when people do bring like their unique knowledge, because nobody else knows it, they don't hear it necessarily, or they don't like revisit it. So it's really important on a diverse team to make sure that this individual knowledge that each person brings to the team is discussed, is brought forward and is discussed. And sometimes one of the mistakes of some of these diversity programs is to create, you know, this team morale and this, you know, sense of we're in a team together. But the more you do that, the less people are going to bring that individual piece to the table. So there's a balance here to do, to really encourage people to not create that shared mindset, but listen to and bring to the table their unique knowledge.
So a level of mutual respect and collegiality?
Mutual respect, collegiality. I mean, for sure you want people to get along and to, you know, appreciate each other. but it's also important to encourage and remind people that they have this unique knowledge to bring out and to find ways. And the team leader, for example, can be instrumental in making sure that they listen for unique information that others on the team just don't pick up because it doesn't resonate with what they personally know. Mm-hmm. Right. So that often happens. So a team leader's role could be really attentive to managing that unique information that comes out to make sure it's discussed and it's given fair time. So yeah, you do need people to get along, but we don't need people to be best friends.
And you probably don't want them to be best friends. So your next research was on diverse boards. So what made you want to tackle that topic? How did that evolve?
Yeah, so one thing I have very mixed feelings about is at some point there was this whole notion of female leadership advantage. You know, just this whole rhetoric, you could read it in all the business press, you know, you put women in charge and like the world's going to become a better place. You know, they increase performance. And I say I have mixed feelings about it because in a way it's sort of empowering, like, wow, I'm a woman, you know, women are there and can basically save the world. That sounds very empowering, but at the same time, it's also disturbing because it requires us to make these very crude assumptions about differences between men and women, which are not as big as one thinks. And it's also super simplistic. I mean, just the example I was telling you before with the IRI thing, we know that, you know, diversity does not lead to good things always. It's hard to manage. And so the idea that you just throw a woman into the mix and, you know, firm's performance is going to explode sounded bizarre. And in addition to that, the research really did not match the rhetoric out there. So while the rhetoric in the business press and everything was around, you know, add more women to boards, performance increases, the research that I saw was that for every study that showed there was this positive link with having women on boards and performance, there was another study that showed, you know, a negative link or maybe no relationship at all. So that's, you know, that really piqued my interest when, as a researcher, when you have these conflicting findings, that's really quite puzzling. So that's how I got into this space, or what really got me hooked into this space.
Okay, so did you find that women were the secret sauce for improved financial performance? I think if you had, we would have seen a lot more all-female boards.
I don't know that there's, yeah, we can talk about that. But so the question, you know, is it a secret sauce? It depends, you know, yes and no. So there are a few things to sort of tease out, right? One of them is, what kind of performance are we talking about? If you look at social performance, corporate social performance, there's a clear, consistent, positive link between having more women on the board and a social and more positive social performance, environmental performance, ethical performance, and so forth. So that seems pretty clear. Again, the differences are not, you know, monstrous, but they're consistent, they're systematic. But most people are usually talking about financial performance. They want to know about that green bottom line, right? But here too, there are, again, different ways of thinking about performance. The two main ones are, one of the two main ones is just how efficiently are you using your resources, right? So sort of return on assets or profitability. And the second one is a market-driven performance. How does the market respond? How does your share price move? One, it makes sense to separate these. And so what I did, and I did a set of meta-analysis with my colleague, Chris Byron, who's absolutely phenomenal. And basically a meta-analysis takes every single study that's out there, and each study has a different sample, right? And puts this all together to try to come up with like the right answer. And so we did this, we collected over 140 studies, you know, representing at least 30 different countries over a wide period of time. And we separated, you know, those that looked at this profitability aspect from those that looked at the market aspect. And because we had all these different countries that were in which these studies were performed, we were able to test a few things, a few of our predictions. And so one prediction we had is that you would see higher performance when you had more women on a board. You would see more higher performance if the board is held to higher standards of accountability. So we know from a ton of research on team, on just regular teams, if you like, that teams that know they're being scrutinized, teams that know they're going to be held accountable, are much more likely to use really the knowledge that exists throughout the team. So how we assess that with these boards and these countries is that different countries have different rules around whether shareholders can sue directors, right? In some countries, shareholders are absolutely powerless. Like if the board is not paying attention and the firm collapses, there's nothing you can do as a shareholder. In the US, you can actually sue directors if things go south. So across all these 40 some countries, there are these different laws. And what we did find is that in countries that had higher shareholder protections, so in countries where boards were going to be scrutinized and held accountable, when you had more women on boards, their profitability increased. They were much more efficient, if you will, internally. So that was one key finding. For the other finding, we also know that countries vary in how much equality there is between the sexes, right? In some countries, there's a lot of equality. Think about the Nordic countries, and others less so. And so when there's more equality, if you have these men and women in the boardroom, they're more at equal level. They're perceived as more legitimate in those roles as well. And so what we found is that in countries with more gender equality, the market responded positively when there were more women on boards. In markets with low gender inequality, with more disparities between men and women, sort of structurally, in those countries when boards had more women, the market responded negatively, did not like it at all. So is there a secret sauce? I mean, there's the potential, right? But you need to make sure you figure out how to use that special ingredient. Team accountability is key, and the level of inequality in general in that particular context is also key.
So you also studied women in top management teams. And so how did having those women in those top executive positions impact organizations' innovation strategies? So, more specific, in the long term.
Yeah. I love this particular study that I conducted with a couple of colleagues in Europe, because what we're trying to do is get to that place. I was telling before how ambivalent I was about this idea that adding women is like a secret ingredient. It's more like, well, what actually happens to those groups when women come on board? And so in this study, that's what we were trying to find out. So we looked at firms and how they changed over time, year after year. Many studies just compare firms at a particular point in time, if you want, across the board. We compared firms over time and how they changed within firms. So that's a big difference. I can tell you what we found, and if you want, I can tell you more about why that is. But what we found is that as women get appointed into top management teams, in the years that follow, the thinking of that top management team shifts. And we know this because we analyzed the text of these companies. We analyzed the language over time, and we compared, how the language changed after appointments of men and after appointments of women. And we found that the language reflected less risk propensity and also more orientation to innovating, to trying and to experimenting. So when women joined these top management teams, the top management team in general shifted their thinking to be more risk averse and to be more open to new ideas and to doing things differently. And we found that if we followed again these firms further over time, that they then also shifted how they approached innovation. So as their risk propensity went down, as their willingness to take risks went down, they stepped back a little bit from doing mergers and acquisitions. They did fewer of them. They didn't stop, but they did fewer. Presumably, some of the less risky ones now were not being done, right? And they also stepped up their investment in R&D, which is, you know, how you'd expect people to shift their investments, because investing internally is somewhat less. I mean, R&D is always risky, right? And there's always a risk, but it's more controllable, if you like, right? And it's about developing talent internally. So we were able to demonstrate that shift over time, what happens when women join these top teams.
Well, we love increased investment in R&D. That's big here. Definitely. So what are you working on now? Where have things evolved now?
Well, so two areas. One that might be also of interest to people here on the call and to people at IRI, I've started doing research on product recalls, and specifically linking the diversity at the top, diversity on boards, diversity on top management team, with how firms make decisions when they have a product that fails pretty dramatically. So some of the research that I've already done, published, is out there, shows that as women join firms in board level positions, firms begin much more quickly recalling products that are hurting end users. So like maybe a month earlier. So there's this increased responsiveness. And I have some other projects that I'm working on also in terms of that recall space and how firms learn from recalls, again, tying it back to those boards and the tone that these boards set at the top that trickle down. So that's one aspect. The other one, I keep being interested in that link between diversity and structure. You know, we can't just focus on diversity and forget the structural inequality that exists, because if we do, walking in place. Exactly. Yeah. So those are just two key areas I'm working on.
Oh, it's exciting. Well, we'll have to bring you back when those studies are done.
With pleasure.
So we've already actually had some questions start coming in. So one of them, it goes back to our first topic, which was about those, you know, career trajectories and how the positive discrimination. So he references, everyone, the white males, got good evaluations from everybody. And he asked, does that include positive feedback from those who didn't look like them, i.e. white men?
Yeah. So that's what's really fascinating and sort of, I don't know if that's the right word, but what's fascinating is that people, we all as a society, we function because we all agree on this hierarchy. Like implicitly, we buy into it. We're sort of conditioned to see things like that. So yes, the positive evaluations come from everyone. It's not like it's, you know, just the other white men that give this positive feedback. Does that answer your question?
I think so. And another question was, so Google found that when people within teams got along well together, innovation is enabled. Is one key in having diversity and innovation matching personality to group outcome?
So ideally, you do want diversity that's going to help for the particular task you have in mind. So the knowledge is important, right? That's what we found with that functional diversity. But a diversity in ways of thinking and just approaching a problem is also helpful. And that's less content driven than just sort of the comfort with either going very sequentially using very proven methods, thinking things out versus a thinking pattern that's about, you know, combining things in new ways. And that's less related to task knowledge. I'm not sure I'm answering. I'm back to personality. For sure. I mean, there certainly are, you don't want to abrasive personalities are bad regardless, for example, right? But personalities matter less than the sort of climate that you can create on a team that creates that psychological safety that enables and encourages people to learn from each other and to learn together. At least that's what we found in that study.
Okay. And so Greg, would you like to jump in and ask your question here? You've got your hand up there.
Yes, thank you. Really excellent talk. I'm wondering if the recent problems that we've had with having to do all remote meetings, whether there's an anonymizing effect. Like if I didn't get to see you, would I know that you have a PhD? Would I know what your ethnicity was? If I didn't have any physical or social cues, how would that affect, you know, my responses to you or my understanding of what you're doing or my ability to innovate with you?
So I would say in the abstract, theoretically, that would probably help. In practice, though, my accent, the words I use, my name. I mean, we're human animals. We want to know what the social structure is. I mean, that we need to know to feel safe. So we're going to be looking for all sorts of cues. I mean, there's studies that show that you can have the exact same person say the same thing with a slightly different accent and people respond differently. So I would like to say in theory, yes. In practice, I'm not sure I think if we could do that somehow with our technologies, that would help. But it might be difficult to entirely get there because that's just what we as humans do is establish these socials, you know, an understanding of our social world.
Thank you.
So we need more avatars is what I'm hearing.
I was thinking the same thing.
I don't know enough about avatars. I think it's actually fascinating that you ask. I mean, how do people create their avatars? You know, is there something about the level of creativity in the avatar that suggests, you know, you have a certain, it gives you a certain status or not? I mean, but it might, yeah. So then it might be dissociated from your race, gender, ethnicity in that case.
But what you'd pick for your avatar, the skins, you could tell I've got children who build avatars for their games.
Right.
You know, what you pick for that, yeah, that would probably reflect who you are and your culture as well. That's fascinating. So one more. So, you know, given all your experience here, and it's vast. So, you know, what steps do you think organizations can take to move the needle on DE&I, just internally and more broadly?
Yeah. So, and that's the million-dollar question with probably
if
million dollars.
Cover that in the next few minutes. That would be great.
Right. So, you know, obviously, working on the numbers is key. I think most organizations have understood this. There's a lot of work out there on how you can, you know, increase, do better job with recruiting, you know, helping develop a healthy pipeline even before people go to school and so forth. Increasingly, the conversation is moving around to the topic of inclusion. So now that you have people in your organization, how do you get them to actually, you know, bring that unique perspective to the table, let it be heard, feel like they're part of the organization. Again, there's quite a bit of work done here. In part, it's letting people be who they are, right? This whole idea. But I think that organizations, another critical step is really for organizations to learn more about how structure affects people within the organization. So a simple one that we've talked about a lot, that you, most organizations have talked about, is work family, right? I mean, that's a structural issue in our societies where still women in general spend, I mean, we've seen with the pandemic, I don't think I need to go into a ton of detail, right? Childcare, a structure around childcare, you know, those sorts of things are critical. But there are also things like commuting times. You know, some studies have looked at whether people from different races and ethnicities have different commuting times, which again does also affect, for example, availability in the workplace. There's, you know, another way of thinking about structure is how we think about what is professional in the workplace. You know, what is professional attire? What is professional, you know, just physical appearance? I know just recently there's the Crown Act that passed that allows, for example, Black people to carry their hair as they want, but that for a long time was not perhaps seen as professional, right? So thinking about the way these assumptions we have about how work should be and how they create structural barriers. Another one is job credentials. You know, for what jobs do you really need the credentials that are being asked for? So in general, I think that's a space where there's a lot of learning to be done and assumption questioning that can be helpful. ERGs, you know, employee resource groups are could be tasked, for example, with helping surface some of those things. But I think it's also a lot of responsibility of leaders to educate themselves and to be held accountable to educating themselves around those particular issues. So I think that's probably a big next area for organizations to really understand how those structures still prevent diversity from creating the sort of innovation we're trying to create, right? Because we're here spending all this time and effort and money diversifying our workplace. But if we don't attend to some of those other issues, it's really sort of an investment that can't have a strong return, right? Because there are these other things coming in the way. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been fascinating. I've learned so much in just a short period of time. You know, I'll give a second here if anyone wants to jump in with another question before we wrap up. I don't think so. And I'll do a short.
I'm sorry. I do have another question.
Go for it.
And I know even as I ask this that it's too simplistic, but the notion of being able to create a metric of those five or six things you said were so important to innovation in a group so that you can sort of measure, you know, for any given work group that's getting together, what is my entitlement for innovation from this particular group? Any thoughts about how that could be done? Because of course, if you can measure it, maybe you can optimize it.
Yeah, so, I mean, the way we did it is simply looking, for example, in the, you know, R&D workforce and their databases out there, I think, just like, you know, what are, if you look at all the PhDs that I don't know, graduated in a particular year that have graduated in the last 20 or 30 years, which groups are more or less represented, right? So if you're a small group and your group has a lot of disproportionately more PhDs, for example, that would give that sense of status in the workplace. So equalizing, finding ways to equalize, and I know, you know, many organizations are working on this to equalize and increase and develop more interest in STEM careers, you know, would be one way. So but that's one way of measuring it, looking and tracking at what percentage of PhDs are from these different groups. Another one is, and organizations do this, is simply hierarchies. You know, if positions of power and authority continue to be disproportionately allocated to, in this case, it's whites, mostly white men, white women too, that's another metric. If that's more proportionately representative of the workforce, you're equalizing, you're creating more equality between the groups. I'm not sure I've expressed that the most eloquently, but does that help a little bit, Greg?
Yes, thank you.
All right, fantastic. Anyone else want to jump in with the last question? All right, well, Corinne, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us, for your willingness to answer all these questions and for sharing your research with us. And we'll definitely be looking forward to your next study. just a quick plug. You mentioned ERGs. We're going to have a conversation next month with Carolyn McMullen from JM Smucker, and she is going to be talking about an LGBTQ plus ERG that she created at JM Smucker recently. So we'll learn a bit more about that. And that'll be on June 13th again, because we've had to change the date. But all right. Thank you so much, Corinne. I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been a fantastic conversation, and I'm sure we'll be pestering you again soon.
anytime for IRI, anytime. It was a pleasure being here again. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.